Hi there. Just a quick note that if you're hearing this, it means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed. I encourage you to become a Misfit right now and immediately unlock every single full-length episode that I've ever done, and you can immediately start learning from some of the greatest entrepreneurs in history. It is absolutely insane how much you can learn for such a small investment, but don't take my word for it. Let me just read a couple of the testimonials from Misfits. It says, I just paid for my first premium podcast subscription for Founders Podcast. Learning from those who came before us is one of the highest value ways to invest time. David does his homework and exponentially improves my efficiency by focusing on the most valuable lessons. Another person said, I stumbled upon this podcast. After one episode, I quickly joined the Misfit feed, since $5 a month is the equivalent of a few cups of coffee for great detailed biographies on amazing leaders. I love the insights and thoughts shared along the way. David loves what he does, and it shines through on the podcast. Definitely my go-to podcast now. And just one more before I get into today's preview. It is worth every penny. I cannot put into words how fantastic this podcast is. Just stop reading this and get the full access now. I agree with every single one of them, obviously. I hope you do as well. If you do, tap the link that's in the show notes on your podcast player or go to founderspodcast.com. It takes less than a minute to set up, and you can start learning from some of the greatest minds in history. It's hard to tell people about Texas. It's hard to explain what it means to be a Texan. But if you grew up in Texas, as I did, it becomes a part of you, as if you're a member of a club. The myths about Texas die so hard, mostly because Texans love them. So much of it is wrapped up in oil. But the fact is, growing up in Central Texas during the 1970s, I never met an actual oil man. It wasn't until I was 16, the weekend I served as an escort at a debutante ball, that I was introduced to the class of Texans known as the Big Rich. They talked of boarding schools and weekends in Las Vegas and wine in Paris and jetting to London, and my head just spun and spun and spun. Though I didn't realize it at the time, those were the years, the early and mid-1980s, when their era was ending. The fathers of those boys were going bankrupt. When my editor suggested some kind of book on Texas oil, I was surprised how quickly a structure sprang to my mind. It would be not about the oil industry per se, but about the great Texas oil families, the ones who generated all those myths. The Hunts, the Basses, the Murchisons, the Cullens. I thought of them as the Big Four, though it wasn't until I began my research that I found out that they had been called exactly that. This book is built on 3 years of research, during which I plunged into dozens of Texas and out-of-state archives, interviewed surviving members of the Big Four families, and read more than 200 books and thousands of newspapers and magazine articles. These and other histories served as a starting point to explore the rise and fall of the greatest Texas oilmen, many of whom are fast being forgotten. There's never been anything lasting written about Houston's flamboyant Glenn McCarthy, though there should be. It's hard to find anyone under 60 who remembers a Texas legend so famous in his day that he adorned the cover of Time magazine. There's even been less written about the secretive Sid Richardson, once the richest man in America. The joys of writing this book were multitude. There's nothing I love more than cruising the Texas backcountry. One morning in 2005, I was in Far West Texas. I entered a tableland whose view was so breathtaking, I had to pull to the side. There, as far as the eye could see, were oil wells. Hundreds, maybe thousands. A lost plateau, filled not with dinosaurs, but with the steel and wire and sweat of American industry. Men had been out there for years, I realized, mapping the land, drilling holes in the earth, returning home to Dallas and Houston and Fort Worth with millions of dollars in their pockets. This was a Texas, an America I had never seen, and I suddenly needed to know what became of these men and their fortunes. Their stories, it turned out, were everything I had imagined and more. There's truth behind legend. There really were poor Texas boys who discovered gushing oil wells and became overnight billionaires. Patriarchs of squabbling families who owned private islands and colossal mansions and championship football teams. Who slept with movie stars and jousted with presidents and tried to corner an international market or two. This is their story, told through the lives of the four Texas families and a few of their peers, who rose the highest and in some cases fell the hardest. Each of their patriarchs began in obscurity, and all, through a historic quirk of fate, laid the foundations of their fortunes in a single four-year span. In time, their days dissolved into a sordid litany of debauchery, family feuds, scandals, and murder, until collapsing in a tangle of bankruptcies. Some survived, others didn't. A few count their millions to this day. That was an excerpt from one of the wildest books I have ever read. The book is called The Big Rich, The Rise and Fall of the Greatest Texas Oil Fortunes, and it was written by Brian Burrow. This was actually recommended to me by a listener, and I went to the page on Amazon, and this is what I read, the first sentence I read, and I immediately ordered it after I read the sentence. It says, this is The Economist reviewing the book, and it says, "What's not to enjoy about a book full of monstrous egos, unimaginable sums of money, and the punishment of greed and short-sightedness?" Okay, so I have a ton of highlights and notes, so I'm going to jump right into it so we don't waste any time. I'm going to focus, there's a million interesting stories in this book, I'm going to focus on the four main founders. That's Roy Cullen, H.L. Hunt, Clint Murchison, and Sid Richardson. So before I get into the four main characters, I want to give you a little prehistory to the Texas oil industry. There's a generation before our four main characters, there was another boom in Texas oil. So I want to read this part because it's really, for me, it was really hard to comprehend, one, the size of these early Texas oil wells, and then two, how the size and the quality, or lack thereof, of that oil changed the world. So it says, "Lucas had never seen anything like it. No human had. The Lucas number one oil well changed the world forever. That first well produced at a greater rate than all other American oil wells in existence, combined. In a matter of days, in fact, the pastures around the well would be producing more than the rest of the world's oil wells combined. Of those first six Texas oil wells, three produced at a higher rate than the entire country of Russia, then the world's top producer." It's called Spindledrop, is where we are in Texas. Spindledrop not only created the modern American oil industry, it changed the way the world used oil. Its dirty little secret was that the oil found there was such poor quality that it could not be refined into kerosene, and that's what changed everything. So much black crude flowed that railroads and steamship companies, it was so cheap, they decided to convert from coal to oil. Other industries soon followed, as did other countries, the British, American, and German imperial navies. Everything that today runs on oil and its byproducts, from automobiles, this is the most important section, so let me read this to you again. Most important sentence, rather. Everything that today runs on oils and its byproducts, from automobiles to jet fighters to furnaces, barbecue grills, and lawnmowers, all of it began at Spindledrop. So the author's giving us all this backstory because in the first generation of Texas oil boom, there's a distinction that I think I need to tell you right up front. So you have the independents, which are just like individual independent businessmen and entrepreneurs that start drilling for oils. They're usually called wildcatters. And then you have the majors. Majors are like Texaco, Mobil, all these gigantic oil companies. So out of the first boom, the first generation of independent Texas oilmen, almost all of them go broke. And the author brings up somebody I talk about over and over again, which is Howard Hughes Sr. And he says that after the only person that really emerged from the first oil boom extremely wealthy was Howard Hughes Sr. And that's because in a gold rush, he was selling pickaxes. This is something you and I have talked about over and over again. I've said on the past podcast, including the one I did on Howard Hughes, that I really think somewhere along the lines we messed up. We're celebrating the wrong person. Although, yes, Howard Hughes' life was interesting on its own part, Junior, that is. It's his dad's discovery and his invention and the company he built that allowed his son to go off and pursue things in aviation and movies and all the other stuff. But Howard Hughes Sr. had to build, in my opinion, one of the most profitable companies that ever existed, and this is the author talking about that. So it says, "What the Spindledrop boom provided was a classroom where the oil business could be learned. A few caught on quickly. Among them was Howard Hughes. Captivated by oil," this is Howard Hughes Sr., obviously, Captivated by oil, Hughes and his partner, this guy named Walter Sharp, began drilling wells. This is in Louisiana. Frustrated by their drillers' inability to penetrate solid rock, Hughes and Sharp developed a drill that could. That's his innovation, that the cornerstone of the empire that he built, right? They patented it in 1908, and Hughes' rock bit became an industry standard. In time, the company he founded, Hughes Tool, would make his son, the legendary Howard Hughes Jr., the wealthiest Texas oil man of all. So moving on, you have this huge bust, or excuse me, you have this huge boom, that then you're going to have a bust. And I thought this was very interesting. And the main point of this section is, like, what if one person could capture all the upside of these giant wells? So it says, the oil man who ran Humble and Magnolia, these are large oil companies. Of their day. He says, survive the lean years of the 1910s by dividing the risk in a very risky business. In doing so, so they spread the risk over, so not any one of them was going to take a loss. But the problem is like, you're also, if you have another boom, which they didn't think was going to happen at the time, they thought it was going to dwindle, then you don't capture all the upside. So it says, in doing so, they also divided the upside. No one in that first generation of Texas oilmen, with the exception of Howard Hughes, created anything like a true American fortune. Their success, however, raised a tantalizing question. What if there really was another spindle drop out there? And there is, multiple times over, all over the world, actually. And what if it was not discovered by a large company, but by a single Texan working alone? One well, one fortune. It was the stuff of myth, the El Dorado of Texas oil. And as a new decade dawned, a horde of young second-generation oilmen would begin trying to find it. And that is the foundation of the story that takes place in this book. And that is going to lead us to the Big Four, all of whom are wild and crazy in their own way. So it says, of all the thousands of men who swarmed into the muddy tent camps in those boisterous years after World War I, four would find the most. Two did it the old-fashioned way, drilling holes deep in the earth. One did it with his mind, and the fourth did it with a fountain pen. If Texas oil had a Mount Rushmore, their faces would adorn it. A good old boy, a scold, a genius, a bigamist. Known in their heyday as the Big Four, they became the founders of the greatest Texas family fortunes, headstrong adventurers who rose from nowhere to take turns being acclaimed America's wealthiest man. Okay, so the first of the Big Four is this guy named Roy Cullen. He's also older than the rest of the Big Four. It says, history has not been kind to Roy Cullen, a fifth grade dropout who in his heyday was probably America's richest man. Cullen grew up poor in San Antonio. He endured a difficult childhood, marked by family turmoil, financial reversals, and frequent fistfights. Cullen appears to have been a stubborn, prideful child, qualities that would follow him into adulthood. Ashamed of the family's poverty, he clung to his mother's stories of his grandfather's Ezekiel Cullen's prominence. So what they're talking about there is the family lost a lot of wealth because they were on the wrong side. They picked the wrong side in the Civil War. So it says, a lonely boy, Cullen hung a blanket over his head at night and retreated inside with a lantern, maps, and dozens of books. Sir Walter Scott, Thomas Carlyle, Shakespeare, Dickens, Blackstone, and plenty of history. He daydreamed of traveling the world, of owning his own business. His favorite dream was of the massive white plantation home that he would build someday, with porticos and gardens, just like the beloved family plantation the hated Union men had burned. Someday, he promised his mother, they would live in it together. When Cullen was 12 years old, the money ran out. He dropped out of school to work 10 hours a day in a candy factory. It's kind of like Hershey, Milton Hershey, we talked about a few weeks ago, right? At 18, he knew enough about cotton to become a buyer. So the cotton buyer at the time, it says it was a roving company representative who negotiated with farmers for their crops. So you travel all over the country, negotiate a price, and then buy that, and then you're going to resell it. Cullen did his business on horseback, almost dying at one point during a blizzard. Interesting enough, there's just one sentence that ties into the biography of Sam Colt that I just told you about. Cullen strapped on a Colt revolver. If you listen to that podcast, you know that Texas was the most important early market in the early days of Sam Colt's company. So back to Roy Cullen. For seven years, Cullen made his way as an independent cotton broker, but he lost most of his savings in the financial panic of 1907. When he turned 30, Colin was itching for a change. He set his sights on learning about real estate. So he's going to try to sell real estate. He does that for a few years. And it says the real estate business, he noted years later, was not exactly booming in Houston in those days. He stuck it out for 4 frustrating years before giving up and returning to the only business he knew, trading cotton. So I just want to pause here. The reason I'm telling you all about this is because what I found most interesting about this part, he's 34, 35, something like that, years old. Nothing in his life up until this point would indicate that this guy was going to become the richest American. And here's the event that got him going down that path. So he's walking to his office one day. He says he was brooding over his dismal prospects one day when a man named Jim Cheek stuck his head into the hall. Cheek was a real estate developer, and he was thinking about getting into oil. He asked if Colin would come work for him, traveling the state to acquire lease rights. And this is what Colin says. Colin's like, I don't know anything about oil, Jim. I've never read an oil lease in my life. Cheek's offer, though, was attractive. All expenses paid, a solid salary, plus 1/4 of anything they brought in. This is actually a smart move that Colin does. Echoes back to what he did when he was a child underneath his blanket. He first headed to the Houston Public Library, where in time he read every book he could find on the geology of oil. What he found was a mishmash of fairy tales and guesswork. Oil fields were thronged with characters who claim, there's just so many crazy sentences in this book, and this is one of them. Oil fields were thronged with characters who claimed to have special oil finding powers. Preachers who swore they had X-ray eyes, and drifters who used psychic powers to direct drillers. Now, in hindsight, this obviously is going to sound extremely silly to us, but at the time, there were indeed companies, entrepreneurs, and others paying people that claimed to have psychic or some kind of supernatural power that they could find oil. And those people made money. They may have made money in short term because they realized pretty clear, if you tell me, hey, drill here, and there's nothing there, you tell me, hey, drill here, and there's nothing there, and over again, that these people are full of shit. But at the time, they were able to make a living, which just sounds really silly to us. Now, one of the reasons I want to pick out a few more parts on Roy is because really his story is one of perseverance. You know, he's struggling in the cotton industry for a while, then he's struggling in real estate. 5 years pass, and he's in the oil industry with little luck. He's still working with Jim Cheek. He's eventually going to strike out on his own, but we're not there. It says for the next 5 years, Colin roamed West Texas, leasing oil rights everywhere he went. All the wells came up dry. What Colin got, though, was an education and a wealth of contacts in and around Houston. By 1920, his wife was making noises about how much he was traveling. Colin was almost 40 by then, and his 5 children barely knew him. So he's like, all right, I'm gonna just come back home. I'm going to drill and try to build my own business based on what I learned, because what I'm working with Jim, it's not really working out. Which is how, armed only with his library books and a reputation for hard work and honesty, Colin decided to drill a well on his own. And this is the first time in his life he's ever going to be successful. We're not there yet. First, he has to persevere through a lot of other failures. To Colin's irritation, the first well came up dry, as did the second and the third. His investors, he was acutely aware, were quickly losing their earlier profits. For months, Colin rose before dawn, kissed his wife goodbye, and drove down to Tramp Damon's Mound. This is the area of Texas where he's drilling. His eyes studying the scrub for anything that might suggest oil beneath. Let me pause there. Geologists just at this time were realizing, hey, if you study what's on top of the land, it might be an indicator of what's beneath it. And so Colin is actually self-taught, and he's one of the first people to use that idea. Many nights Colin didn't come home at all, grabbing sleep on the ground beside the drilling rig. When he did make it home, streaked with mud and sweat, his skin pimpled with insect bites, his wife would be waiting on the veranda, and they would walk up the stairs in silence. "Let me get a shave and a bath. Tomorrow is another day," he would tell her. But the days stretched into months, then into years, and every well came up dry. This is what I mean about just the story of Roy Colin, just more and more hard work and more perseverance over and over again. Colin spent 36 months at Damon's Mound, the most frustrating period of his life. 3 years in hell, he called it. Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you want to continue listening to the full episode, you'll need to upgrade to the Misfit feed. By upgrading, you'll get access to every full episode that I've ever done. These episodes are available nowhere else. And as a bonus, you also get lifetime access to my notebook that contains key insights from over 285 podcasts and lectures on entrepreneurship. As a way to illustrate why it is so important for you to learn the lessons from all the biographies that I analyze on the Misfit feed, I have some quotes that I've collected from other people who have discovered the value in reading biographies, and they explain to you and I why this activity is so valuable. So the first quote comes from the founder of Shopify, Toby Lütke, and he says, "Books are the closest you will ever come to finding cheat codes for real life. You can access the entire learnings of someone else's career in a few hours." This quote from Mark Andreessen on why he reads biographies. "There are thousands of years in history in which lots and lots of very smart people worked very hard and ran all types of experiments on how to create new businesses and invent new technology. They ran these experiments throughout their entire lives. At some point, somebody put these ideas down in a book. For very little money and a few hours of time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience. There is so much more to learn from the past than we often realize. You could productively spend your time reading experiences of great people who have come before you and learn every time." And finally, this quote from the book, The Tao of Charlie Munger, on why Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett have both read hundreds of biographies in their lifetime. "Reading personal biographies allows one to experience multiple lives and successes and failures. Reading business biographies allows one to experience the vicissitudes of a business and learn how problems were solved. Both Charlie and Warren are copious readers of personal and business biographies." So upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com.